So some questions from the that have been submitted. And the first one from the chat this morning. And just so you know, I'm often not attuned to the chat while I'm talking. So I happen to notice these questions at the end of the session when I see the chat. So, you're welcome to put things in the chat. Just know that I may not notice them in real time. So this question was about something I was talking about this morning. I was talking about how mental formations condition experience, and talking about mental formations as being the activities of the mind, those action, the those qualities of the mind that shape experience. And I used the term mental formation there. That's from the Buddha's teaching on the five aggregates, which is a kind of a description of our conditioned experience. That's my understanding of it. The Buddha describes five processes of body and mind that interweave, interrelate, and interact with each other to shape what we're experiencing. And those five are form or bodily experience, the bodily processes. And then the other four are mental processes, feeling, whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, the process of perception, of recognizing experience. And you'll see we've been talking about these all week. I just haven't put them in this context. Perception. Then mental formations, which are the activities of our mind, which includes thoughts, emotions, feel, moods. Our attitudes are in there. And so the question is attitude the same as or part of the aggregate of mental formations? And I would say it's a part of the aggregate of mental formations, the attitude. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness, the quality or the capacity, the function of knowing that happens in our mind. So the mental formation aggregate is understood to shape the experience. It's the driver of how all of the other aggregates tumble forward and are shaped. So whatever our mental formations are, they affect how our feelings are, how what our perceptions are, what we know, and how our body feels. And then those mental formations in turn respond to how our feelings are, what the perceptions are, what the body sensations are. So it's just this kind of tumbling on there. But I would say the attitude that we're exploring is really, the what may be kind of in the back of the mind when we're exploring what is the attitude to experience. It's kind of the mind that's being the part of the mind that is kind of we are looking through the filters on experience. And so when we become aware of those filters, then those attitudes are no longer functioning as attitudes. They're just experiences. They're just objects. And so the way we're talking about attitudes is something kind of in the back of the mind that is kind hidden in a way. I guess I wouldn't go so far to say is that all mental formations are attitudes, but attitudes are definitely mental formations. So I would put it that way. Thoughts are thoughts, beliefs, any kind of mental activity is an attitude. I mean, is a mental formation, and may or may not be an attitude. And then several questions on practicing in and with relationship from different perspectives. And so this struck me. There's a few questions on this topic, and kind of grouping them together to explore something about this topic seems to be like it would be a useful thing to explore. So I'll take each question individually, but there will be ways in which some of the responses are kind of connected. How do you practice mindfulness dealing with a judgmental, impatient, difficult person in daily life? One thing I'll say here is that when we're in relationship with somebody who is showing their reactivity, showing their impatience, their judgment, their attitudes of mind, making them clear and making them obvious. Those are kind of contagious. So this points to how conditioning, I mean, this morning we were really exploring conditioning in terms of how does our own experience condition our experience? How does the attitude that arises in our mind condition our experience? Well, here there's also when we are really in relationship with the world, with other people, with different cultures, with our families, we start to see how much we are shaped not only by what happens internally, but by what happens externally. So the conditioning process also kind of comes, we're shaped by what happens externally, and often in ways that we are not aware of. So for instance, you know, we can be shaped by our family patterns and habits and just take those to be how families are. And being in whatever culture we grow up in, we may just take that conditioning and the way we relate to people. I mean, even just some really simple things like how close you stand to somebody that you've never met before, or whether you make physical contact with somebody that you've never met before, and how you make physical contact with somebody you've never met before. Those are things that we learn just kind of through. We are conditioned to learn those things through being in our whatever soup of conditioning we're in. And we often don't even know that that's conditioned or anything that's shaped until we get into a situation where a culture or a family or something is acting differently and we notice discomfort. So just to point to this way that we affect each other, it's pretty potent. And we all know this, I think. And I think part of the reason why it's so difficult to deal with somebody who's really judgmental and angry and difficult and impatient is because those emotions are contagious. I mean, it's like we are designed. This is from neuropsychology, and I understand is kind of like the mirroring. Our systems are designed to mirror each other. And so if somebody is impatient, our system can kind of resonate with that and then feel impatient ourselves. So there's that way in which we are conditioned by each other. So practicing with this is beginning to recognize, you know, that we are actually being shaped by somebody else, somebody else's mind, somebody else's experience, and to be aware of that. To also, I think a big piece of this in terms of helping to find a way to be balanced and grounded around it is to understand that other people, you know, this person, you know, somebody judgmental, impatient, difficult, that person is living out their own conditioning. They have been conditioned in their own soup of experiences, and you know they're experiencing suffering when they're experiencing that judgment and that impatience. They may not be aware of it, actually, I think, but we can all know that this experience, or we can know that coming into meditation, I was unaware of what it felt like to be angry until I started to pay attention. I was unaware of what it felt like to be impatient until I started to be curious about these mind states, what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. And so I was really unaware that I was suffering when I was angry until I met the mindfulness practice and began getting curious. And then I really felt how painful it was. At one point, while I was observing the anger at this person that I was angry with, I noticed the arising of a wish for that person to be really miserable, you know, for that person to suffer, basically. I saw that wish in my heart. And that was so humbling. You know, it's like, wow, you know, this is what's here in this heart and mind. I haven't wanted it to be that way. This has been shaped based on causes and conditions. And we also see as we practice how hard it is to control our minds. You know, it's we feel anger arise, we feel impatience arise, and we can't just turn it off. We do learn the tool to meet it in a different way, which is huge. It's huge to have that capacity to turn and not be driven by it, but to be open to that experience. But we see, even being open to it, how hard it is to be with it, and that we have very little control over these mind states that come up. And so for me, that kind of seeing into my own mind, both seeing how my mind in a space of anger wants to lash out and make somebody else miserable, how I have very little control over my own mind states, you know, that the mind states are shaped by our conditioning. And I'm extremely grateful for the practice, which has now shaped many different forms of mind states than anger. I don't experience that level of anger anymore. Not to say that I don't experience forms of anger, but just that depth of anger is just, it's not there anymore. And so the mind has been shaped by this practice in a new direction. And the good news about all of this is that these states of mind, calm, ease, peace, kindness, are also contagious. They're a little subtler, perhaps, than the anger. So if somebody's really angry, they may not quite catch it. but it can be, if you're working with somebody, if you're talking to somebody who's got a lot of anger, if you respond with anger, it's like, you know, gasoline in a match. It's just going to flare up. If you can be with yourself and know, wow, this is hard. I'm feeling some activation here, but maybe I can take some breaths and try to, you know, recognize that I'm being activated, not to repress the activation, but that I'm being activated. Maybe I can respond in a slightly different way. But what I would say, I mean, there's a couple pieces here. So, you know, one is just kind of the recollection of the reflection. This person is just acting out of their conditioning as I act out of my conditioning. So that to me has created the space of humility and compassion for all kinds of different, working with all kinds of different people. And I do find it's useful to take breaks, to find some space, to reflect, to use those reflective practices, really useful to use those reflective practices on situations where you tend to get charged. Can be useful to you know, use some simple tools. There's all kinds of tools out there in the psychological realm to support working with and navigating, you know, the things that I've seen in dealing with speaking skillfully when when there's a charged situation, there's all kinds of tools out there. And you know, one good one is just to repeat what the person has just said, give you some space to kind of think through it. You know, it's like, so what I heard is this. And I hear this is really frustrating for you. You know, and this is, so I'm hearing the frustration, but this is how I'm hearing, you know, you're taking this. And so give yourself some, you know, that first of all can help to diffuse them a little bit, because they feel heard, and it gives you some space to settle a little bit. So there's all kinds of tools about communication out there in the world that are very useful to give you some space. And then I would say mindfulness underpins all of it. You have to be aware. You have to know what's happening in order to take a pause, in order to take a breath, in order to repeat back what someone is saying. So awareness of what's happening, and awareness of how charged and how quickly it can arise, you know, how quickly that contagion happens, and some humility for yourself of, wow, here I am getting really frustrated with this person again. You know, okay, this is my own conditioning at play. So I think that some of those reflections can be helpful in terms of navigating some of those difficulties. And then I'd say, you know, we often will act and speak unskillfully in situations like this, and we're not going to do it perfectly by any means. And so something I encourage, you know, get really good at cleaning up the mess. When you've made a mistake, when you've said something unskillful, the kind of the making amends, or offering a, wow, I'm really sorry I said it in that way. I was, you know, not speaking well in that moment, or, you know, just things like that. But do take care with making amends, I'd say, because notice the motivation around making amends. Is it to support, is it to make you feel better, or is it to somehow support the other person? So yeah, I mean, making amends can be a skillful thing to do, and it can happen now in the moment when something happens, if you catch it, or it can happen at a later time. So another question about relationships. So much suffering happens in our relationships. I appreciate all the information that you can offer on the subject of awareness while talking, and especially while there's the added complexity of conflict. So this is a similar question in that, you know, but it brings in a little bit more about being aware while talking. And so, you know, I thought I'd just review a few of the kind of mindful speech tips. And I just, you know, mentioned there's a lot of tools out there. Nonviolent communication is a well-known tool that supports mindful speaking in a skillful way. There's a lot of others. But just in terms of what I've explored, just in terms of mindfulness while speaking, just the first piece is just to begin to have the capacity to know you're talking while you're talking. But in this case, in this kind of a conflicted situation, some of that charge happens while you're listening. Listening tends to be an easier place to be mindful. So, you know, get familiar with what happens, you know, what it feels like as the charge starts to rise. You know, what does it feel like as the system goes into lockdown? What does it feel like as the energy goes up and kind of starts to rattle around in your brain? Awareness shuts down, you stop listening, you start thinking about what you're going to say. If you can catch the beginnings of that process, while listening. And it's a little bit easier to do that while listening than it is while talking. But if you can catch the beginnings of that process of, oh, there's some activation. Okay, you know, can I listen and breathe at the same time? You know, just find some way to connect with experience and not try to figure out the answer in that moment. You know, just give yourself some space to listen. And then an important piece can also be, before you respond, take a moment. I mentioned this earlier, you know, if you can pause before responding, you can possibly know what you're going to say. So this is a little bit, we talked about catching the intention before acting this morning. This is in the terrain of catching the intention to speak before speaking. You know, you may have the feeling of wanting to speak or, you know, needing to say something in return, but give yourself a pause there with when there's conflict, when there's a sense that you are charged or you are, you know, having your energy elevating and the danger of losing mindfulness, give yourself a pause. It feels funny sometimes to pause in a conversation. It's not the usual flavor of exchange. And so it can take some courage to just be silent for a moment. But give yourself that space and then notice what you're going to say. And even that moment of pause can give you potentially the understanding of what you're going to say and the opportunity to possibly choose to either say it differently or to pick something else to say. Like maybe recap what they said instead of saying what you were going to say first. So just give yourself some space before responding. So again, I think one of the simple ways to notice whether activation is starting is to notice whether there's a kind of agitation or ease in the listening and in the talking. So just attending or attuning to that. Is there agitation or ease? As we can begin to be more present with being aware while talking and know whether there's agitation or ease, then we can start while talking, being aware of the effect, the impact that the content that we're sharing has on us, and also potentially aware, because our minds will do this, our minds in conversation will kind of model or notice how our content might land with the other person. We have that capacity. And again, we can slow this down in writing. You know, so an email conversation that's charged, you may be able to really do this more easily. So you know, noticing the content and what is the effect it has on you, this content? Is it charging you to think about this content? Is it, you know, getting you back into your reactivity to think about this content? Then maybe it's time to try rewording things. I've noticed even just a single word when I'm writing an email or something, it's like a single word can create a little bit of a ugh in me. It's like, ugh, that doesn't feel good. Or that feels like a little bit of a activation in my own heart and mind. And if I just shift the word, you know, from a slightly blaming word to something that's more neutral, my system can kind of relax. So that may not be able to catch that in real time. But again, you know, this takes practice. This is a huge practice. It is such an area of challenge for us. So noticing the impact of the content on yourself, of what you're thinking of saying, what you're thinking of offering, and also potentially opening in a kind of a broader relational way to how that content, what you're thinking of saying, might affect the other person. This is a little bit of imagination, but you know, there's often a sense that we have. And again, in that terrain of constriction or ease, Constriction or ease. It's almost like we're putting ourselves in the other person's place. If I were receiving this, how would it affect me? So noticing the impact of the content on your experience. And then potentially you might also be able to notice, again, this is as the mindfulness gets more available, I would say in the midst of conversation, you may not be able to think about how is this affecting me? You know, it's when the mindfulness strengthens and there is the mindfulness available that we begin to feel how content affects us. We may also begin to be able to see, again, not something necessarily to do, but something that can be seen, is why we're going to say what we're going to say. Now, with speech, again, we may be able to pause enough, you know, taking those pauses, we may be able to know what we're going to say and maybe something about why. And again, is the why a, you know, wanting to push in the barb for somebody? Is it wanting to educate them? Is it wanting to get back at them? Is it wanting to be a little more curious about what's happening? So, you know, kind of some curiosity about the motivation. What's the motivation for why you're speaking? And again, getting really good at cleaning up the mess. Yeah. And then one more that is speaking to this kind of cleaning up the mess. Another question. How do I practice when thoughts of the harm I caused interfere with allowing and accepting what I observe, especially defilements like anger that resulted in harm? I'm open to observing what's difficult, but I'm noticing an energy that wants to make amends and fix, which I recognize is not accepting things as they are. I also recognize the harm is in the past and making amends is future. I just do not understand how to be in the present moment, having caused harm and observing thoughts that result in feelings of shame. The ethical foundation feels compromised. So here what I'd say is, you know, we do feel often this sense of, you know, when we recognize that we've caused harm, this sense of shame, of guilt, of self-blame, often is what happens. And, you know, there's a fine line here. I would say mostly a lot of the time, those feelings are self-recriminatory. They're self-negative. We feel like we're a horrible person. It's not a discerning kind of, oh, that caused suffering. That was not helpful. It's, you know, it's I was a horrible person. So the key here is really looking at that kind of shame, and, you know, self-recrimination, the blame, all of that terrain of self-judgment there when we've caused harm, and we know we've caused harm, is to understand that the sense of blaming ourselves, the shame and the blame, are a tangle of experience, much the way we talked about the tangle yesterday afternoon, that inside of that tangle, there is something that is actually discerning that wasn't so helpful. And that's a wholesome quality. So the Buddhist teachings talk about some wholesome qualities around when we've caused harm. There's two that the Buddha speaks of, and in the Pali they're called hiri and otapa. So hiri, in my understanding, hiri is kind of when we think about what's happened in the past and we feel the sense that that was not so helpful. You know, the sense of conscience, our conscience is tickled. Tanisaro Bhikkhu translates hiri as conscience. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates hiri as moral shame. And that translation I find a little bit challenging, because the word shame in English so much has this self-blaming, self-recrimination quality to it. And so to me, that word, it's like, how can I understand moral shame, this hiri quality, as a wholesome quality when it inherently feels like shame has self-aversion to it? So I like Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation of conscience, which really kind of points to our conscience gets tickled. You know, it, something feels off there. There's the acknowledgement, yeah, that wasn't helpful. And in my own experience, there was an experience I had at one point where I did something, you know, I responded to something a little bit quickly, a little bit more quickly than I should have. I should have taken some time probably to check in with some of my colleagues and, you know, check the situation out a little bit before responding to this request. But I, you know, was in a little bit of a rush and responded to the request. And it was like I was standing in a pool of gasoline and I dropped a match. There was so much suffering that resulted from that quick response, from that situation. And I worked with the kind of the feeling of the shame, the guilt of that, of having done something that created so much harm, and began to get curious about the feeling of the shame, of the guilt itself. And then as I was exploring it, I actually felt into that quality of hiri, of like, wow, yeah, it hurts to have done something that hurt others people. It hurts. It's like, it's akin to compassion. Our heart hurts when we see other people suffering. And when we have been the agent for that, it hurts like twice, you know? So that's the hiri. It's that kind of the pain of knowing that something we've done has created harm. This is actually a wholesome quality. The Buddha calls this a guardian of the world. Now, in my touching into that, the feeling of the wholesomeness of it, again, there wasn't the constriction there. It was that jello-like feeling where the heart could feel the pain, not only of the pain of the other people that had suffered as a result of the action that I'd done, but also the pain of having been the agent of it. It really felt that pain very openly, without constriction. And then I felt it like just the subtlest tip into self-identification. I did that. And the constriction around it. The feeling there was so close to what that identified feeling of shame. It was so close that it was pretty easy to tip into it. So it really took some kind of dedicated presence of mind to feel that feeling and notice when it tipped into identification and that sense of self-blame, as opposed to just that pure sense of, yeah, that wasn't helpful. And I took that process, you know, over time, I took that process and that feeling to reflect on, is there an action I need to take? So, you know, making amends can be something that is useful. And I did take some action at a certain point. You know, I got a response back from somebody which had some blaming and some anger and all that stuff in it. And it's like, okay, let me just take some time here and I'm going to respond to this. And I apologized. You know, I said, this was not my intention to cause this harm. And yet harm was caused. I am so sorry for this. And, you know, I made my amends in that way. I won't go into the details. There's too much there. There's this connecting with hiri allowed me to respond humbly and from a skillful perspective, allowed me to make amends more humbly and from a skillful perspective. So we were at time, so I won't go into the other half of the teaching. I'll just mention that otapa, the other piece of that moral conscience or the moral emotion, is kind of about noticing what, like if we reflect on or think what we might do, take actions, you know, our mind will model what we might do. In those moments, if we are thinking about doing something that might cause harm, we will feel it. And that is otapa. That sense of knowing that what I might do will cause harm. And Thanissaro Bhikkhu calls that concern. So we are feeling the concern of our actions, how they might affect someone else. So, yeah, that's all our time again, but I did want to take some time to really explore and unpack working with relationship, because it's such a huge part of our daily lives. And so I hope this was helpful. And again, I'm happy to stay for a little while afterwards, but you're also welcome to unmute and say goodbye if it's time for you to get on with your day.